Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
I was going to say Scotty Hertz, but I think I might be Richie to the Fonz over here. Gee, Fonz, I don't know.
Oh, man, that kid never knew.
Shortcake.
Shortcake.
Yeah, we're going to do a whole show in Happy Days voices. For those of you that remember 1976.
Yeah, I think we will really jump the shark then.
Yes. Oh, well done.
Thank you. Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading Open Source's the podcast version on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and the Google Play. Today, we're going to look at the guilty verdict rendered against the former chief of staff of former Premier Dalton McGuinty, whether or not that will have an effect on the coming election. Maybe not so much with other things being talked about today, which we will talk about in a minute, but we'll see. And then there appears to have been a serial killer in Toronto's Gay Village for the last several years, and the clues seem to all be there. But it took police a long time to put it all together, it seems, so we'll talk about what went wrong there. And then finally, NAFTA may be coming to an end soon, depending on the mood of President Captain Underpants, I guess. But no one really knows just where the negotiations are going. We're going to try and discuss the latest on that. But first, we love breaking news on Thursday. First of all, we'll get to what happened with Ontario PC leader Patrick Brown. Yes, that is a breaking news alert. This is we've gone full Wolf Blitzer here with our breaking news alert.
Breaking news out of Queen's Park. Over to you, Adam.
It's not Queen's Park. It's House of Commons. Kent Hur. We're going to talk about.
Oh, Kent Hur. Sorry. Breaking news out of Ottawa. See, we blew it. I don't know.
This is actually... Okay.
It's live. Just happened minutes ago, folks.
First of all, it's not breaking news if it happened last night. I just want to say that. Because that's where...
Broken news out of...
That's where all the CTVs and the CBCs and the CNNs, you know, get their heads firmly tucked up their rears. They call breaking news that happened 12 hours ago breaking news. No. This is breaking news. Statement from the office of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Harassment of any kind is unacceptable, and Canadians have a right to live and work in environments free from harassment. As a government, we take any allegations of misconduct extremely seriously, and we believe that it is important to support women who come forward with allegations, and that is exactly what our government will do. And I will skip the next paragraph now that we got the preamble under the way. Today, I accepted the Honorable Kent Hur's resignation from Cabinet pending the outcome of the investigation. During his leave of absence, his ministerial duties will be performed by the Honorable Christy Duncan, who will serve as Minister of Sport and Persons with Disability, in addition to being the Minister of Science. So Christy Duncan taking on some additional responsibilities from Kent Hur, who, as this against Patrick Brown was breaking, more allegations against him were breaking, so it's been a very busy day in harassment news.
And Jamie Bailey out of Nova Scotia, right?
That's
allegations
right.
of inappropriate behavior down there, so
yep.
across the board.
Yeah, well, it's...
provinces, federal.
And I feel like Jamie Bailey kind of got buried. I mean, he's probably grateful for that, nationally speaking, but...
Trumped, so to speak, by the late... And it was late-breaking news. What happens, and I think Adam does the same thing, just before bed, checking the feed, and it was like, what? And I was like, the first thing I thought when I heard story one was like, he is done.
Meaning Brown.
Patrick Brown, yes. Yeah. So for those of you that have been sleeping all day, do not know, Patrick Brown is no longer, he's no longer the leader.
No, he stepped down as leader. He says he's going to remain as MPP while he fights the allegations against his good name.
Good luck with that re-election there, Mr. Brown.
Well, he doesn't even have a seat in... He doesn't have a seat in Barrie, does he?
It's not Barrie, is it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's... that was always going to be tricky for him to begin with. It's strange how this happened. To recap the timeline, about early yesterday evening, CTV had this story, two young women who alleged that when Patrick Brown was MP for Barrie, Patrick Brown, serving as a backbencher in Stephen Harper's government, he assaulted one and harassed the other. There, and one of the girls at the time was in high school, so that adds another level, extra level of skeeviness to it. He came out around 9:30 and had an impromptu 1 minute long press conference where he basically said he denied the accusations, and then he was literally chased out of Queen's Park by reporters, got into a dirty van and drove into the night.
Dirty van.
And
with a teardrop
the van
window.
Was dirty.
I didn't actually see the van part of it.
Anyway, and then around 1:30 in the morning, his office releases a statement that he's resigning. I'm actually quite surprised that he made it through the day without announcing he was resigning as MPP as well.
Yeah, and it was very quick after his executive. Who was it all together? There was four or five executives.
It was the press secretary, the campaign manager, the chief of staff, and the deputy campaign manager.
Who had strongly suggested to him, please step down. But he, the last gasp there, which was the press conference. And if you haven't seen it, you should look it up because it was, I wouldn't say catastrophic, but I think he must have come out without guidance. So there was two things going on. He just was sort of freewheeling,
yep,
trying to defend himself, ran away at the end of it.
Yep.
So he didn't take any advisement. Because I think it's because he didn't have anybody left to advise him. They were done. When that team says, you're done, and the deputy leaders, whose names I didn't actually know, and I think they spoke earlier this afternoon, because, I mean, you don't really think about the deputy leader until you need to. Deputy leaders Sylvia Jones and Steve Clark said to him, you can't lead us into an election as a result of these allegations.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was holding out faint hope. And I think sometime at 3 a.m, it sounds like that was the timeline. And by this morning, it was like, okay, you're done. So do you happen to know, because I did a little bit of poking around, because obviously the next question is beyond the allegations, which he says he's going to defend them in court, but obviously if it's not brought to court, then it won't happen. That remains to be seen yet.
Right.
What is the process, or do they even have a process to deal with this? Is it one of the deputy leaders? Can they randomly pick somebody?
For leadership.
Do they have to have like a power convention and pick an interim leader? Are all of those a possibility? That was the part I don't know. Like, this is probably unprecedented at the provincial level. I can't even think of it at any other level that somebody, you're minutes away from the election and you're done.
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I think all the options are on the table. I don't think there is a contingency for something like this. The trick is, I mean, we have to keep in mind, even before this, Patrick Brown was on thin ice. He had the SoCons, social conservatives, who were kind of mad at him. He was taking the party center. You had people who were mad at him because of apparently tipping the scales and nomination fights across the province. You already had working groups, kind of marshaling their efforts against him. I mean, remember last fall, if you watched TV at all last fall, you probably saw an ad against Patrick Brown. And being a flip-flopper and
the
all
women's
that.
Women's group, right? Wasn't it?
It was the women's working women, something.
Yep. Working women's coalition.
A lot happened today to revisit stuff that happened 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. But, he was already treading water in terms of going into this election. It's going to be curious because given how seriously I think a lot of conservatives... And this isn't an insult at all. They take the democratic process within their party and choosing leadership and responsibilities. That stuff is very, very serious. I think many of them are going to want to go whole hog into a lightning round leadership convention, whether that's, like the full-blooded in-person convention or something online with online voting or something like that. I think a lot of the people in the executive, like the people who run the actual day-to-day mechanics of the party, are going to be like there's going to be an election call in 3 months.
Yes.
Can we really afford to not have our ducks in a row by taking like 6 weeks and having a leadership convention?
Well, and I guess one of the options too is that they could go with number two, who is Christine Elliott.
Yeah.
Who is very popular within the party yet, I believe.
But she has a really nice job.
What does she do now?
She's an ombudsman, a patient ombudsman for the Ministry of Health.
Right. So, and also has political experience.
Right.
A little bit of name recognition, I guess, and sort of an unsullied character or background. She was Jim Flaherty's wife. I think people know that. A political powerhouse couple, long running in Ontario.
Yeah.
So she would probably be a possibility. One of the other names I heard, which was interesting, although he said no the last time and didn't run, was Michael Chong. Came up as
I've heard people say Lisa Raitt, too.
Lisa Raitt. Like anybody who was...
Who would be, I think...
13th place in the federal one would probably do really well.
Well, I mean, she was, like, clearly playing red Tory Ontario politics in her race, which is one of the reasons why she was, like, 13 out of 14 or wherever she finished. I think she would do really well. But, I mean, are you going to... I mean, this is a Hail Mary pass at this point. You're coming into a really dangerous situation. Is she going to want to give up her federal perch? I think she's deputy leader.
Yeah, that's
under Scheer.
The rankings.
So is she going to, like, is she willing to ditch all that to parachute in and lead the Tories into what was already going to be a difficult election? I doubt it. In a couple of years, I would love to see that because if it was a couple of years ago and she wanted to do that, that'd be one thing. It'd be interesting to see a provincial race with 3 out of 4 major party leaders as women. But
and I think people are doing a bit of their hopes, like they're projecting as to, wow, could you imagine if it was this or that?
Yeah.
Or, oh my
Carolyn
God.
Carolyn Mulroney, big projection.
Yeah.
Big projection. Well,
I mean, I suppose it's a possibility. Well, for the record, Patrick Brown is the MPP in Simcoe North, but he's nominated to run in Barrie, Springwater, or Omadante. Now, both of those are in the Barrie area. I'm not sure if there's been some redrawing of the ridings. I think there was.
They're adding seats.
And that's why that's changed up a bit.
Yeah.
So he's nominated to run. So that will be another race they will need to rerun because...
If he decides he's not going to run.
That's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen either, but we don't want to get ahead of ourselves.
No, but odds are good.
Odds are good.
I
saw a comment on Twitter before going on air today that, you know, someone's like, can we talk a little less about the politics, about who's going to run and things, talk more about like the circumstances that led to this? And I think that's fair.
And that's true, yes.
Because one of the things I noted, and I got a bit of crap for this from an actual CP24 anchor, because I definitely noted this watching the coverage today. A lot of people are like, I wrote it down. Hold on. Vic Fedeli, who's an MPP, was holding a little scrum. He's from North Bay, I think.
I heard him on the contender list.
Yeah, and I've heard him on the contender list too, and he's very well spoken. I hadn't heard of him before, but he was very well spoken, I have to admit. Somebody actually asked him, should someone lose their livelihood because of allegations? And I was like, really? Whoever that reporter is, they should be... I was going to say they should be fired, but...
Where
I mean,
was
this
the
is,
scrum? It could have been anybody, right?
Yeah, it could have been anybody, but I mean, that was such a dumb question. And Andrea Horvath answered this perfectly. When somebody asked her something similar about, you know, going through the criminal justice system, and she said, well, I got two words for you, Gian Gomeshi.
Oh, yeah.
And she's absolutely right. It's and this gets back to what you were saying about how he was going to defend himself in court. What is that going to look like? Because nobody's pressing charges. And the Barrie police have said repeatedly today, you know, nobody's pressing charges. CTV, the New Regional Report, protected the identity of the women. One woman went on camera, be it with her identity concealed. Another woman did not. So, you know, it's going to court is a whole other step. Mm. It begs the question, is he going to sue for libel or slander? Is that what he's getting at?
And I was thinking about that, too. Is that lawsuit against him still standing from
when?
Yeah,
I believe so.
It must be, right? So that might be withdrawn very shortly.
There was a lot happening today. And I actually did think Kathleen Wynne actually did a pretty good job at her comments.
Yeah,
because... didn't result in, you know...
Her first comment didn't even... The first tweet I saw, which was her first tweet this morning, she didn't even mention Brown.
No.
You know, she said, as you were saying, that, you know, we need to focus on
the
women.
Culture. Yeah,
very true. So, yeah, I didn't see any of her later stuff in the day, but that first one, there's no need to mention him simply because, like, he's done.
Yeah,
he is done. So,
but I mean, the cultural aspect of this is really starting. Exactly. And I've seen on Twitter women describing, you know, sort of this culture in Barrie, how it's a community where there are a lot of older people, you know, because Barrie, surprisingly, in certain Charlie. Respects, is a bedroom community. You know, a lot of people live there and shoot into the GTA on the GO train every day. So you have a lot of kind of 40 middle-aged guys about. Meanwhile, you have, you know,
their children.
Georgian college and other kind of little community colleges there. A lot of young women who go out to the bars trying to have a good time. And, you know, in here arises this, you know, patriarchal culture of, like, of, you know, cruising the younger girls. You think you're the slick.
You're the big wheel teetotaler.
Yeah, teetotaler.
Jeez, I go to all these bars when I'm a teetotaler. And it's like,
Yeah, interesting. That's kind of suspicious.
No, I won't make any speculations on why you would do that,
but
there is a list.
Yeah, so I mean, there have been implications that there's this kind of culture in Barrie of the guys, the older guys, cruising the younger women, and you know, basically, you know, pulling a you can do whatever you want kind of feel that perhaps been pervasive for too long. And the other thing, I've seen a lot of people attack the one accuser who was a volunteer. She was a university student, but volunteer organized an event for Brown, and that was when after that it was when she alleged he assaulted her.
And was that the one that was at his house?
Yeah, and then she went back to work the next summer. And a lot of people say, well, why would you do that? And it's like, are we really still having that conversation? It's a pattern we've seen that you can't really understand what goes through the head of a victim until you've sort of been in that position yourself. And it's a pattern we've seen of victims trying to, you know, ignore it, trying to bury it, trying to overcome by just trying to, you know, put it in a box and not thinking about it again. And that's incredibly unhealthy. And the culture that created that isn't very unhealthy too. It's been saying to women for years, it's like, you know, forget the bad, you know, predatory behavior of men, because you've got to overcome that. Like it's some kind of thing to overcome. It's like one of these little signposts along the way of life. In order to get ahead in life, you have to leapfrog over the man that wants to touch you. And
if we started hearing more stories of men getting punched in the neck or the cojones, would not surprise me at all. I personally, in my view, would wholeheartedly encourage it. If that behavior comes to you, I hope not. But yeah. Anyway, evolving story.
Evolving
more,
story.
More to follow.
More than likely.
Yep.
We'll have to revisit that political stuff at some point. Speaking of political stuff, this was the big election story last week.
What's your show? Political stuff.
Yeah, the
Welcome to Political Stuff.
Welcome to Political
Stuff.
We're
your host.
What are we talking about? Remember the gas plant scandal?
Yes.
Well, that used to be a thing. That was
7 years ago. Yes.
Well, David Livingston, who is the former chief of staff for the former premier, Dalton McGuinty, was found guilty of, and I want to read the exact charges because they're kind of hilarious, unauthorized use of a computer and attempting to commit mischief to data.
Isn't that like everybody every day, everywhere?
Yeah.
Data mischief.
Data mischief.
It's growing.
It's a growing crime field. His deputy, Laura Miller, was found not guilty. I believe the judge said something to the effect of it seemed impossible that she wasn't involved somehow, but he couldn't convict her beyond a shadow of a doubt.
The old not proven.
Yeah, so she gets to go back to helping the BC Liberals not win elections out there. In the meantime, Livingston, his sentencing is at the end of February, and it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see a couple things. First of all, what kind of sentence is he going to get? Because my guess is slap on the wrist, probably time served, maybe some probation. The other thing is, like, is anyone going to care about this at all? Or like, why are we still caring about this?
Well, that's the thing. I think initially, at least I was going to approach this story from, like, can they make political hay out of this and enough to sort of tilt the balance in the election? But obviously, the events of the past 24 hours or less have blown this out of the water. But then, of course, there's a lot of reasons why it isn't on the radar. Like, it set off the top there, 7-year-old story. That was 3 elections ago. And Livingston, there was a direct association with Dalton McGuinty, who stepped down. And I think a lot of it was to do with this, and Wynn was installed. It was a big part of getting
McGuinty
out of the way.
Yeah, Livingston. I think
Livingston as an operative in the shadows, along
right,
with
it happened.
The boyfriend. Wasn't it Laura Miller's boyfriend?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Did the actual deleting?
Yep.
And he was just a lackey, I suppose, by the sounds of it. So he wasn't even on the radar.
Yes.
His name is out there, but...
I think it happened, during the transition when all these things were deleted. So it was after Kathleen Wynne won the leadership. Of course, I mean, this was hinky from the start, because this is something they announced during the 2011 election in order to curry favor in Oakville. And where was the other place? Peterborough?
Mississauga.
Yeah.
And then there was a story today saying that the power plants that have replaced them, I don't know, they spent a lot of money on them. They don't really power them up too much.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Sarnia.
And it was outside Sarnia and outside Nepean.
Yeah.
And the new Nepean plant is right next to another plant that isn't used very much.
Is it coal? That might be one.
It didn't say. It just said it wouldn't have been coal, because it had been in operation 33 days last year. So.
Oh. Runs on love. No, I don't know.
That would be sweet.
Yeah.
But not much of that today. But
no.
That's interesting, because that's kind of the flip side of the story, is that they spent $1 billion, canning the ones in Southern Ontario, and then it spent $1 billion building the new ones in places where their electoral hopefuls are not as great. So I mean, that's dirty. But I mean, my problem with this has always been, and Martin Cohen got to this fairly
on the Star.
Yeah, in the Star. The problem was never the cancellation. I mean, that was problematic in that they said it was going to cost $230 million and ended up costing $1.1 billion. But the problem was not the crime. It was the cover up. And I don't worry
about the money. It was the cover up we're worried about.
Well, everybody was promising to can those plants anyway.
Yeah.
It's just the Liberals were able to do it first because they were in power at the time. So it's like, we heard you guys and we canned them. And it's like, you don't need to elect a new government to can stuff. We can stuff. So, I mean, I think there would have been, I mean, it still would have been an issue, but it wouldn't have been as big an issue if Dalton McGuinty had just came out. It's like, yeah, we were in power. You didn't want those power plants. We canned them. Everyone was promised we canned them. So what? And, I think there would have been, some mad respect for Dalton there.
But to make sure you never know the reason why we're going to triple delete the drives and
yes,
put nails through them, and it's like, you're never going to know.
Yes, that's...
Because that's... And that he had said that was their policy or something. It's our policy to do that. It's like, actually, no, it isn't.
Well...
You're supposed to maintain the data, right?
It was
when it was paperwork, and even then you could either incinerate it or shred it. So it's not like it was...
If it was their sort of personal data, I would say they have good data habits. You definitely do. You don't want to be throwing out hard drives with your data in it. But those aren't your personal tax returns. Those aren't your personal credit card slips. So that's government
of the state
of Ontario information and invoices and emails and all that stuff. That's not your stuff to cavalierly throw away and sneak your boyfriend in to do computer hacker ninjutsu and. In the middle of the night or whatever the heck happened, it just looks dirty, dirty, dirty.
Yeah, it's like these people are like the Watergate burglars as opposed to Nixon himself. It's more like they're on the periphery. So as to whether that's, I don't think if there's any effect on the election, it's going to be negligible. I mean, even beyond what has happened, like we were talking about.
There have been two elections.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be, it's not like they're going to be, it'd be one thing going from place to place going robocalls, but if you're going as David Livingston, everybody's going to go, what? Who?
Yeah.
You mean the Explorer? who are you talking about?
Yeah, it's, I'm not sure, I think this is a bigger thing that conservatives, the hardcore conservative sort of political operatives are more in love with than the average voter. I mean, again, watching online today in the Patrick Brown story develop, a lot of people are of the, even people who didn't like Patrick Brown or like conservatives are like, oh, okay, great. Now it's going to be another 4 years of Wynne. It's going to be another 4 years of Liberals. And it's not necessarily they hate Liberals or they hate Liberal policy. It's that this is a tired government. And if they were banking on this to make hay, the gas plant stuff, that just doesn't
jive. I think
there
was a time. There was a time.
There was a time.
Where this would have been. But then again, there's a time when the, you know, assaults would just sort of go. Or, you know what I was thinking back to was, I guess it was Gary Hart.
Sure.
Remember he had the woman on his knee that was not his wife.
Yeah.
And he was done.
Done.
Now you have this different level, you know, the Trump level where it's like sex with whomever and you pay them
adult
off.
Adult film stars,
and
yeah.
The best was that might actually be a campaign expense. somewhere in the accounting. So it's like it's all been amped up, and I think that's what's missing from this. It's like, all right, it's like, what did Diefenbaker lose on that the dollar had gone down a couple of cents compared to the US dollar, right? It's like now there needs to be more, which is hard to believe considering there's like a billion here, a billion there. It's $1 billion. Whatever.
Well, we're getting back to the billion. I mean, it's not that it's good that, you know, that $1 billion was wasted and that it appears that the construction of these power plants have been kind of wasted to begin with. It's
that would show that ruin of like the hunks of reinforced concrete just sort of drooping. It's probably gone now. I don't know what's there now.
But
condos.
In that Star piece, they made a note that, you know, in 2004, we used 153.4 terawatts per hour. In 2017, we used 132.1 terawatts per hour. Now, that some of that might have been because we had a relatively cool summer as compared to other years. But otherwise, it has been a trend going down in terms of total electricity uses.
Well, and I would add the disappearance of industry to that, too. I mean, we're going to get to that probably with NAFTA, which is one of our upcoming topics, but that is definitely a factor as well.
Plus
efficiencies that have been found in LED lighting. Yeah,
efficiency.
Ask your electrician.
Yes.
But
it's been going down a trend. Now, I understand the idea of having some kind of redundancy.
Yeah.
But building another plant next to a plant that you barely use? Like, well, there's redundancy, and then there's just hoarding.
If the premises is going to be mothballed.
Well, there's
I guess
that,
part
too.
Of it, too, putting it down maybe Sarnia way is anticipating that industry will pick up there, whether it's oil and gas down there, the chemical industry, or even automotive. There's significant automotive down there, isn't there, in Windsor, Sarnia?
Sure. So, I mean, it's right across the river.
So that may be the guess on that, but
maybe.
I don't know.
I think that's optimistic, but
the logic of it, or was it purely, were they purely paying politics, putting it down somewhere where it's kind of out of the way?
Yeah.
And we won't.
Well, that's the question, because the five seats in question in Oakville and Mississauga, they're all still liberal.
Yeah.
Which,
and they're probably not going to change.
Right. So if,
because the people in those areas are happy that Lakeview is gone, which I grew up in the shadow of. I mean, that was, you know, that was pure coal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Sending ash down on us on a regular basis. So a gas plant, not so bad, but or not as bad anyway. There's still a footprint, but it's not like,
right,
you're
and
not,
yeah,
living in the carbon. So,
right, it's
yeah, they're gonna stay.
The effect is come and gone.
Yeah.
Like, there's, you know, it's for you know, the only people this is going to have cachet with is the people who were, you know, last weekend. And you retweeted that last weekend with everyone going crazy because the one wind turbine blew over.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, gotta get rid of wind power. This is ridiculous. And it's like, you know how many times some oil tanker has, you know.
Yeah, like the one that's, what do they say? It's the size of like Paris now, the spill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many
burning
times has some, yeah, some oil tanker ruptured? How many times has some pipeline ruptured? And, you know, if the first time that happened.
No one's ever worried about a wind spill, right?
No one's,
or a solar spill.
Wind spill.
Oh my God, there's a solar spill.
Yeah.
I didn't bring my SPF 30. That's probably the only thing you got to worry about, really. And do you have enough bottled water?
I'd love it if we had a wind spill. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
My God, the wind.
Okay. We're going to take a break and then come back with more wind spills. No, I'm
new
kidding.
Band name.
Serious topics, especially one that affects queer people in Toronto. That is quite serious. And we want to put on our serious faces and come back with that. And you're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
La 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 la.
New to the station, that was the Penny Blacks from their album Long Lights, and that song is called Scrimshaw, Coming of Age Triumph. The Penny Blacks. Visit pennyblacks.ca for more info on that band. That was a nice little tune.
Are they coming to town?
Could be the no, they're not actually. This their tour listing ends in December, so they might be. I don't know. Hillside. When all else fails, just say yeah. They're probably coming to Hillside.
Yeah,
I shouldn't say that because
it makes you sound like you're in the know, and then you're like, I thought you said, and it's like,
what? Rumor has it.
Rumor.
Just gonna start with rumor has it, and then they're definitely coming.
I was just reading this breaking news. Are you a skater or a sledder? Interesting. Somewhat.
Ice or. Do they mean the skate park?
I imagine it's the ice variety. I literally wasn't reading it. I just saw the headline. Anyway, we were supposed to put on our serious faces, but
yes.
Stuff happens.
Right
in the
now.
Gay Village, which is along Church Street in downtown Toronto. For years, people were worried that there was a serial killer on the loose, and it turned out they had every right to be concerned. A man named Bruce MacArthur was arrested last week. He was arrested in suspicion for having he was charged with first-degree murder, but they haven't found the remains yet of these two men, Andrew Kinsman and Salim Essen. And the police have been undertaking a very thorough check of properties where Bruce MacArthur worked as like a groundskeeper or a property manager or something like that. And they have not found anything yet, but I mean, it is an understandably scary sight in places all across the city of Toronto, seeing cadaver sniffing dogs and police tape. And
the white suits going in and out of the garage.
You know, that's the thing you never see on the CSI shows. They're never wearing the protective suits when they're collecting the evidence. They're always super stylish. So it is quite the scary sight when you see real crime scene techs working, especially in your own backyard. But I think the real scary part, and this goes for a lot of gay men in this part of the city, was that they have really strong suspicion to think that MacArthur was sort of cruising the area for victims as far back as 2010. So this is something, a cloud that a lot of gay men in the area have been living under for, 8 years?
At least, and maybe even further back. I mean, that is the recurring thing that you hear, is like there may be more victims. It's in all likelihood there are. There was a list making the rounds in the media, particularly the gay media. I'm thinking of Extra magazine in particular. And Now magazine covers the Church Wellesley neighborhood as well regularly.
Right.
There was a list of 5 people that were missing. And there was a murder, or somebody found murdered in the, like a trans sex worker found murdered in the Rosedale, the valley, the scrubby part there.
Yeah.
And there is a tendency, or the perceived or realistic, that the police tend to kind of write certain people off, not just in the gay community, but okay, here you have a trans sex worker found dead, living rough, homeless, regardless of your orientation, homeless. I think you automatically, just my opinion, and the same with some others, you get slotted into this certain category. And that can be said for the village for sure. Now, Chief Saunders said that, you know, they were handling this. This was back in December, that they were handling this with a certain amount of sensitivity, as he put it. But they did this weird kind of like, well, there's no evidence to establish, or there's no evidence to exclude the fact that there's a serial killer in the village. That's their catch-all. There tries a bit of butt coverage there, let's say, to right. try and say, well, we're not excluding it, but we're not ruling it out either. So it's kind of wishy-washy.
Even though everyone up to Kinsman was kind of a same type, sort of middle age, older, people of, an ethnic background, gay men, and...
Well, the balance were brown, too,
right.
generally, right? And there's a lot of emphasis put on the apps, which the community doesn't have come out saying that, no, it's nothing to do with the apps. I mean, all sorts of people use dating apps, gay, straight, you name it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the police focus, and rightfully so to focus on it, because, I mean, if you want to hook up with a stranger, apps are the way to do it. I think the one that MacArthur used was something called Sugar Daddies, and there's all kinds, right? But there was one link mentioned in Extra, which I thought was interesting, is that I mentioned that there were five specific people missing. It seems one of them was known in the community to have dated MacArthur. This is beyond the two, Salim Essen and Andrew Kinsman. This is somebody else. Or
there's
somebody, definitely a link established.
I did read up on that. It was a man named Skandorig Navaratnam.
Yeah.
They were apparently off and on, and somebody made the point of MacArthur was actually on Navaratnam's Facebook feed.
Yeah,
and then we kind of get on top of that today. Somebody did some digging that apparently MacArthur was banned from the village after a charge in 2003.
Yeah.
He beat someone with a pipe. Even after that, he was seen sort of cruising the area, and I think it's not too far off to go too much further to say that maybe he was cruising for victims.
Yeah, and that's, top of that. That's the thing. I mean, I don't think people realize, like, it's not a closed community. Like, you can obviously go there.
Yeah, there's no border patrol.
But like any community or like any neighborhood, people know things. They know each other. They know people to recognize them.
Right.
When I lived in Toronto, there would be community events of this and that, not just for the gay community at 519 Church, which you keep hearing about. That's like their main hub community center next to the Metropolitan Church, mm-hmm. is 519, and the famous Second Cup steps, which they made fun of on Kids in the Hall regularly, are across the way there. I think that's all changed. It's heading in the gentrifying direction. But interestingly, there was a death in the community of the young woman who was not gay. The Tess Ritchie, right? Was it Tess Ritchie?
Mm-hmm.
The 22-year-old. Who had a fight with somebody, and they're looking for a person of interest. They seem to have these camera shots of Tess Ritchie and somebody else at a hot dog stand. They seem to have all this data on her right away, yet somehow these other things, they somehow can't go back and find similar.
Right.
And there was one person in the community, probably more than one, made the comment. They said, if this was the... he specifically said the white women of Rosedale being plucked from their bedrooms, mm-hmm. there would be like hundreds of cops on the case. So I don't think that's too far off.
I don't think that's too far off either.
But now that they have something on this MacArthur guy and have charged him, then obviously, you know, they're on the case now. That's, you know, it's difficult to say whether
I'm hesitant to you know, bash the police too much, because it does sound like they were dedicating resources, and part of this was a systematic thing, because you can't declare missing persons, which all these cases were. You can't declare them cold cases.
No.
Because they're missing
no
persons.
Body.
Cold. Yeah, because there was no body. So you know, the system
yet.
Yes.
Or DNA.
The system seemed to kind of let them down. On the other hand, there seemed to be really a kind of systemic issue in the police, in that it seemed, with a little bit of digging, you know, you have Justin Ling of Vice sort of going out into these areas where seemed to be connected to the case, the graveyard near where the one person's car was found, which is, you know, leads to a trail, which is very well known for gay men to go and have,
yeah.
you know, sex on the down low, going all the way back to the 70s. But what we have here is, I think that the police are sort of very focused on the culture of the out and open and proud rainbow flag on every street post version of the village, not realizing that, you know, one of the victims was still very much in the closet. He was leading a double life. He was calling his wife, saying he was going to be late to work or going out with friends. What he was really doing was going down to the bathhouse. So it's hard to investigate a case openly and honestly when your victims are leading a double life, and you only kind of understand the one side of that life, which is the open public face, and you don't really get the underside of the life, which is the one you're trying to hide and keep secret.
Sure, but I think we do see those kinds of deceptions across the board. Now,
sure.
You know, whether that led to his demise, probably not. But Yeah, I suppose you're right on that. It's just that there's such a long history in this neighborhood of conflict with police. In fact, it's the one of the established facts, the bathhouse raids. I think we spoke about that on the anniversary of it.
Yeah.
Not long ago.
Right.
So there is a certain amount of tension there, and I guess that's held on. Of course, like you mentioned, the Pride Parade, the things that have gone on with that, and do we exclude the police from that? But they're obviously on it. It's not like this has happened and they've just. I think there was a time where nothing would have happened, right?
Yes,
it would have just been,
right.
You wouldn't have seen the people in the forensic suits and that. It just would have been,
right.
Oh, it's the Church Wellesley Village. No, don't worry about it.
Yeah, we got a guy. What are you complaining about? I do think that is important. Because going back to what Black Lives Matter was trying to make the point back in, I guess it was 2016, when they shut down the Pride Parade, was that despite the improvements in the relationship to the police and the queer community, there were still areas of the queer community who still understandably feared the police and felt the police didn't understand. I think this is a clear example because, of course, many of these victims here were not white Canadians. They were, brown.
Like I had mentioned before, the black trans sex worker, it was Alora Wells, was their name. Found in the ravine, not high priority. So there's a scale, I guess, as to what serial killer. Yes, high priority.
There's a scale, and
substance
I think,
abuse issues.
Right,
da, da, da.
And I think that's the point that Black Lives Matter was kind of get that,
yes,
and admittedly it's kind of glossed over.
Mm-hmm.
And I meant to being one of them, those people who are like really you got to dump on this. But I mean, I think this proves
an important point
that it was an important point that. Something was missed. Yeah. Speaking of missing things, NAFTA, we may miss that shortly. They just finished the sixth round of negotiations. I think there were supposed to be three rounds originally, but now we've gone to six and there will be a seventh. They're expecting a final update in March. It was funny, kind of last week, everyone was talking about it's only a matter of time now before Donald Trump pulls the ripcord, and that seems to have been tempered somewhat this week. And I guess some of that has to do with the fact that in Davos, Trudeau finally signed the TPP Part 2 or the TPP sequel, and that may be lighting a fire under some of the U.S. negotiators who maybe aren't as hardline as the president himself. That there's maybe real danger of not. Of losing the advantages of trading with Canada?
Yeah, it sounds like there was a lot going on this week. It was like Minister Champagne on the phone. Like you're doing this one deal, the NAFTA deal, and then you're doing this other TPP deal on the, because lots of them are in Davos, I guess. The team will be out there. And with Trump there as well, and may get a little quiet on the Trump front in terms of trade because it seems that anything that happens, like the TPP getting signed, he's probably not happy about that because he still has this, there's two things, the whole protectionist, good old USA kind of thing, but also he seems to have this background hate sort of for China.
Hmm.
I mean, economically, I don't know about racial. I'm sure racial's there too, but what I'm specifically speaking to
they did treat him very well when he went there.
Well, of course, yeah. Good host. But it's like, bad deal. We have a bad deal with China. We have a bad deal with Canada. Mexico, don't even get me started on Mexico. That's the way Trump looks at it, very black and white. It's like, this is a bad deal. That's a bad deal. We want to create American jobs. So anything that seems like another country is getting the advantage, whether it's some of the big ones coming up with NAFTA, the content of cars, the auto content, that might just get completely changed up. And there's a link to the TPP with that as well, mm-hmm. in that parts just start washing in from China and the East. That not only affects, it was Jerry Diaz, who's got his own set of issues right now with the Unifor leaving the CLC, but he's very, it's weird seeing a labor union having a pro NAFTA march after everything that happened when free trade came about the first time. I was like, okay, so you're marching in favor of this, even though like 30 years ago, the Canadian auto workers were like, no way, never in a million years. So it's amazing how things change on that front,
right,
or those fronts. So,
well, it's, you know, I think it's has to do with trying to hold on to what there is. I think that's sort of always the reflexive action, is that what we have is good. Change is inevitably going to be lead to a worse situation. So, you know, if whether you're getting into a free trade, that's going to be bad. Whether you're going to get out of free trade, that's going to be bad. And I think that's the immediate reflexive action.
With every electric car that comes out of the market, too, I mean, it's like there's no... We don't even, they're not even on the radar here in terms of manufacturing, are they? There's no
electric cars?
Yeah. There's no electric car made in Ontario. It's all.
I don't believe so.
No. So.
But I mean, that would, you know, with all the talk about the quote unquote new economy.
Yeah.
That would be something we would get on. Maybe not trying to persuade Amazon to come here, but maybe trying to persuade Tesla to open a plant here or something. I don't know.
And I suppose that's a possibility. But it's just to the degree of, I guess, trying to hold on to the jobs isn't going to happen. If that's the case.
Well, it's not only that, but it is really trying to hold on to the jobs, which is why, you know, every couple of months somebody's coming into Linamar to give Linamar another check, whether it's from the feds or the province.
And she's on the she's on the team, right?
Hasenfratz?
She's on the NAFTA Advisory Council. I'm near certain about that. Yeah. And also, as you mentioned off the top, that was the first thing I heard on the weekend was Rona Ambrose, who was also on the team. This is a cross-party thing.
Yeah.
And...
Andrew Scheer was doing like glad handing with like U.S. politicians to like to buttress support for
NAFTA.
They all
kind of put the differences aside when it comes to something like this.
Yeah.
And Ambrose said that as well. It's not if, but when Trump's going to pull the plug. Everyone seems to be convinced of this. So I guess it's like, almost like in permanent damage control. It's like, please don't.
Well, I wondered that, but I also wondered too if that was like a negotiating tact. If that was like... working the reverse psychology angle, because it does seem like Donald Trump is, I mean, not that Donald Trump watches Canadian news, but if the team is going around with the opinion that, you know, promoting the opinion that NAFTA is done, is that going to have like a reflexive action on the part of Trump, who doesn't want to be seen as predictable or wants to be seen as surprising or wants to be seen as someone who gets the upper hand on people? Would that, you know, sort of, you know, his negotiators going back and saying to him, you know, they're really expecting us to drop this thing. And, you know, would that sort of like, I haven't made a decision yet, even though he comes out at one of his rallies and says, I think NAFTA is toast. And that's what he did at one of his rallies a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
It's just, it seems almost quasi-manipulative. On the at least in retrospect, after coming out of the week where it's like, no, we're having good progress, we're having good meetings, and
he seems to do the flip flop, of course, depending on who's buttering him up, right? So if they can, you know, if the Canadians can leave a good impression, the Canadians, I mean us, I suppose, but if the Canadian team can leave a good impression with him, but again, like I said about China too, he seems to have the pathological hate on for Mexico, right? So anything Mexico, even though they're massive trading partner with the U.S., right? But of course, it's a bad deal and it's unfair. You better leave a hole in the wall for stuff to come through, right? So,
well, let's not forget.
But only in one direction.
Let's not forget he fundamentally misunderstands the situation. He's been selling
the wall.
He's been selling the wall, but he's also been selling a story about how if we get rid of the trade deals and lower corporate taxes, all the jobs are going to come back. And that, you know, four out of five jobs that have vanished in the last several years, that's not trading, that's not taxes, that's automation. Yeah, trading and taxes have an effect. Certainly, when Burger King bought Tim Hortons and moved their corporate operation up here, they weren't doing it because we make better better Whoppers up in Canada. It was because they were looking for certain... It's because we're looking for certain tax advantages, but that's not the same in every case. That's not the same in manufacturing, where robots are doing more of the literal heavy lifting, or in coal mining, where robots are doing more of the mining. It's just, unless you're going to go back in time and push Alan Turing down the stairs, automation is a fact of life, and it's only going to get more automated as we go on.
That chess game is just going to get tougher.
So it's, you know, he doesn't really understand the issue from the get-go. He's reaching for easy answers. He's reaching for the applause line, which is, let's get out of NAFTA. Meanwhile, there's people working hard, really trying to come up with creative solutions. And the word from this is that while Canada and Mexico are being creative, the U.S. is being intractable.
Yeah, I was going to mention he's probably reaching for the chicken bucket as well, if the health reports are anything to go by. So, uncertainty in the air, yes, definitely, because I don't know when they're going to have an announcement on this.
March.
Is it March?
The deadline is March.
They wanted it in March as whether how many more meetings are going to have. And this is the first one up here, right, in Montreal?
Ottawa. I think they've been doing
hopping
one
around.
In Canada, one in U.S., one in Mexico. Then
hopping around the capitals, and now they're up here. So, it's one of those, we've talked about this a lot. So it's just, I wonder if it is going to be one of those things where there's just all of a sudden a bill and Trump's like, bang. Because that would be my guess, is I was like, okay, NAFTA's done.
Reuters polled 45 economists. Only four of them said that the U.S. is going to pull out. The rest thought it's going to be same old NAFTA with a couple of tweaks.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone is arguing that it should stay the same. No one is arguing that because it's now on the verge of 30. Is it? Yeah, 88, right? It would be 30 years old.
The original
deal, which was Canada,
bilateral.
Yeah, Canada, U.S., and then Mexico.
Yeah.
And do you remember the election that was fought over that?
Mm-hmm.
The liberals were like,
for those of you old enough to remember.
No freaking way we're going to have free trade. So John Turner.
Well, John Turner, we don't have to worry about John Turner anymore.
No, but I'm just saying how it's amazing how things change. Now it's like all the parties are, please hang on. Although, are the NDP, I believe Brian Topp, there's a name y'all haven't heard in a while, is on the NAFTA Advisory Council. And this was interesting. Hassan Youssef, who is the head of the CLC. The problem is he's there as a Unifor member, so he may not be the head of the CLC much longer because since the Unifor have disaffiliated for now, until that comes completely crashing down, they may need to install somebody else, a la Patrick Brown, but for different reasons. So
way to bring that full circle.
I did do that, didn't I? Wow. Some days we're on the game.
Some days.
Other days, not so much.
And speaking of some days, we just want to put a quick plug. If you are someone who is still concerned about electoral reform, Democracy Guelph is having a little performance art this Saturday at noon outside Lloyd Longfield's office at 40 Cork Street East. They're doing a little zombie walk to promote the 1 year since Justin Trudeau officially broke the promise on electoral reform. If you want to dress up as a zombie, that is encouraged. They do ask that you don't go with the blood and guts. It's kind of old school Romero, Night of Living Dead zombies. So lots of white makeup and ratty clothes.
Monster Mash grade.
Monster Mash grade. Yeah, rated G zombies, Scooby-Doo zombies. You'll be good to go.
I would have had that electoral form if it wasn't for those darn liberals. No.
That'd be great. Scotty will be gone next week.
Yes, I'm on assignment.
Assignment for your job. Anyway, so it'll be me and some guests. We'll have to wait and see. And then on the February 8th show, we will be preempted for Black History Month programming here on CFRU. We are going to put together, though, a special podcast-only version of the show, a shorter version that you'll be able to get online on Thursday at 5 p.m. on the 8th. So you will still be able to get your weekly dose of open sources via the podcast channel. And you can find us on opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter, and that podcast channel is the Guelph Politicast channel, which you can find on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. I am at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Twitter, Scotty Hertz on Facebook, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
And DJ Sounds Good to Me is here at the top of the hour on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I will be back here next week from our Open Sources Thursday at 5. Scotty will not, but
I will be listening at CFRU.ca, possibly, maybe.
Well,
see how the day goes.
We'll see how the day goes, and we'll see how the week goes, and we will see you next week.